to another meeting of the Vancouver Institute. We have a very good crowd again. We've had a very interesting program on this after Christmas now, and we have many more lectures to come. And the audiences and the talks vary. Today we have the Max Sinatra fan club here, I noticed. He's spoken before at the Institute, and many of the people in the audience will have heard him before. And for this fan club, I have, first of all, a message that if you want to hear him again, which we shall want to in the future, I urge that you, when you go out, you sign up for the Institute. That the Institute lectures are free, of course, but we thrive on people who give their affection to the Institute by taking out annual memberships. So we urge all of those people today who haven't yet had the opportunity to get memberships to do that when they leave tonight. In this very special evening again, we have Max Sinatra, who's been at UBC for almost a decade. He came from Europe to MIT, to Dalhousie, and eventually to the west coast of Canada, and he came here about a decade ago. Max is known in many places not only as a near miss as an astronaut, but in particular as for his wonderful work on the human brain. And today we have a special treat of hearing Max speak on brains, genes, and society. Please give him a hand.
Well, thank you very much, Eric, for that generous introduction. The title of my talk today is Brains, Genes, and Society. And I must admit, I'm not quite sure what I was thinking 6 months ago when they asked me for a title and I gave you this one. But I've been working to try to come up with a talk that could fit around it. As Eric may have mentioned, I'm in the Department of Ophthalmology at UBC, and so most of my work has been concerned with vision, the parts of the brain that are involved in seeing, the parts of the nervous system that deal with sensory inputs. And so when I talk with you today about the brain and how it works and how it develops, I'll be talking primarily about vision, but I want you to think of what I'm saying in quasi-metaphorical terms. So in some cases, I'll be talking about vision, and I want you to generalize wildly, think of audition, think of smell, think of other senses, think of motor systems, and I'll try to draw the right analogies when, as the time comes. Well, let me start out by just talking with you a little bit about seeing and visual perception. If we think about the problem, if you will, of vision, the problem of how we see, many people think of it as almost a trivial problem. The famous physicist Leo Szilard in the 50s decided he would go into vision and thought he could solve it in a few weeks. It is more complicated. But it's deceptively intuitive. You know, we just look out there and we see things and we can immediately grasp the reality that is around us. But there's a lot more to seeing, to perception, than simply registering what is on our retina. Our brain operates on that visual image that comes in through our eyes and makes a complex series of judgments and deductions and operations on that image. And I want to just show you a couple of slides just to make it obvious to you, I hope, that how non-trivial the perceptual process is. Now, I don't know how to control the lights. Can you maybe turn down some lights in the front, Eric? I don't actually know where to push. If you look at... I don't actually see any lights here. Well, if you just look at this... if you look at this first slide here, what you can see are a series of four triangles. Now, if you compare, for instance, this triangle, the one with the white background, with the other triangle on the black background, And I ask you, which of these two triangles is brighter? How many of you think that this triangle is brighter than that triangle? Hands up if you think this triangle is brighter. Okay, many of you do. How many of you think the opposite, that the bottom triangle is brighter? None of you think that. Well, the answer is that they're exactly the same brightness. But to most of you in the audience, it will look as though this triangle that is surrounded by black is brighter than the triangle of the same brightness that is surrounded by white. And this is because we aren't just looking at our brain is a lot more than a photometer. A photometer would know we'll get this answer right all the time, and many of us would not get this right. And that's because what we do is our visual system makes a series of relative judgments. We compute the brightness of this triangle not in an absolute scale like a photometer, but relative to what is around it. And so, of course, this one tends to look brighter than that one. Let me give you another example of our visual system making relative judgments. Have a look here at this scene of railroad tracks, and look at these two white bars. Now, which of these two white bars looks bigger to you? Well, the answer to almost everyone is that this far bar, this distant bar, looks much bigger than the bar that is lower down in the screen. In fact, they're the same distance from you. This is a flat slide. But because we believe, based on our experience, that this bar is farther away, it looks bigger. If you measure them with rulers, you'll find they're exactly the same length. Okay? And you can go ahead and you can try with your thumb or something like this, and what you'll find is that they're just exactly the same length. There's no difference in length at all. And yet the visual illusion, even after I tell you that they're the same length, is still very compelling. You can believe me. If anyone wants to borrow the slide, you can have it. Okay. Now, our visual system adds value to the retinal image. We don't just take in what's there. We add a lot to that raw sensation. Now, if you look at this slide, you see, most of you will see four black objects here and a square in the middle. Does everyone see that? Okay. Well, I have news for you. There's no square. There's absolutely no square at all in this picture. There are only four Pac-Men. That's all there is to it. There are just these four open mouths here making up the corners of the square. If you run across with a photometer here, there's absolutely no contour at all. There's no change in brightness, no change in luminance, no nothing. Okay? And yet, virtually everyone in this audience will see a line here. And what this is our brain basically compensating for the inadequacies of the media. So like if you have like a little photoreceptor that's dyed along here, then we have a process in our brain that sort of takes care of those little imperfections. If there's a little glitch in your visual system, we have central processes. And the evidence is that this is done, that this process is in fact done quite far central. We have central processes that fill in the gaps in our visual perception. Just as we see through our blind spot, so too we can see through invisible contours. Give us a beginning and an end and we will make a middle. Okay. Now, the mechanisms by which this is done are being explored by scientists worldwide. Let me show you another slide. Now, this is a very simple slide. All it is 12 lines. They're all roughly the same length. Now, I want you to just sort of stare at this slide and, you know, try to figure out sort of where the front of the cube is and where the back of the cube is, and see if any of you notice anything unusual about it as you continue to stare at it. Are any of you, is anything strange happening for any of you yet? Are you feeling very consistent in your thinking at this point? What you're seeing, what most of you are seeing, is the visual system faced with a stimulus which has multiple explanations for how it got to be that way. And what you're doing is you're operating on that visual image, you're forming hypotheses about what's in front, you're using everything you've learned about the laws of perspective and of geometry, and you still come up with two answers. And for a while you settle on one solution, and for another while you settle on another solution. But it's a very simple stimulus, which evokes a very complex and powerful percept. We're very, very interested in what's going on in your brain at the moment that you flip between those two interpretations. And based on technology that is now coming available, we're going to be able to understand what is actually happening in your head while you change your mind, so to speak. So our visual system begins in the retina, and this slide is a view of the two eyes. I guess I can't show you. I guess if you look here, this is a, I guess the easiest way to describe the perspective here is as though, let's say that there's a person here and you can see his brain, and he's looking at this lady up there on the top, and the perspective is sort of as though the top of the head had been cut off, and you're looking at a flattened section. It starts in the eyes and goes through to the visual cortex. Now, the point of this slide is not to give you a detailed anatomy lesson, but to show you that the visual cortex is here in the back of your head, and that the way in which our perceptual systems operate is that we have, basically, what we have is a distorted map, a distorted, amplified, anisotropic map of the visual world, which exists on the surface of our visual cortex. So that if you're looking right at this lady's nose, and that's this point here, it's represented here. And we devote a lot of the cortical surface to looking at the area right around the front. So when I say look at someone, I mean point my fovea at someone, and that the representation is right up here, and there's a lot of brain devoted to processing that. And there's only a little bit of brain devoted to processing the periphery, the side of your visual world, and you can see that, I guess over here, if you can just make it out, this 7, 8, 9, this little hand. So what we actually have in our brain are a series of neurons, and I like to think of neurons as being little people, each of them with their viewpoint about the world, each of them interested in particular aspects of the world, and each of them with their own little biases in terms of what they're interested in. So a neuron that is located right here, and there are of course millions and millions of them in your cortex, is interested in what is going on right in front. And within that, you can sort of imagine it as like looking through a long tube, very small tube, and it's interested in what's going on at the end of that tube. Is what's at the end of the tube green or red or vertical or horizontal or near or far or rightward or leftward? And what we seem to have in our cortex are a series of little, I call them operators or filters, that are interested in particular aspects of that visual world. Now, the problem of visual perception comes down to the problem of how it got to be this way. And one of the most active areas of research in visual perception has been the study of visual development and how that visual development process is influenced by your genetics and by your environment. Now, I've put this slide up to remind me, these are two unfinished sculptures by Michelangelo. And one of them is called Atlas, and the other was called Youthful Captive. Now, these sculptures are unfinished because they're metaphors for brain development. Now, we know that the brain starts out, the body, in fact, starts out as a single cell, and there's division and proliferation and more and more and more and more. And you can sort of imagine as a first-order approximation the development of your brain and body as sort of ever-expanding multiplication. But the point of this slide is to tell you that after birth, and also before birth to some extent, there is a process of sculpture in the development of our visual system, where actually a large part of what develops is pared away, is actually eliminated. And the rules of this elimination are under active study by a large number of scientists across the world. So let me just give you a couple of facts. You may not know that you lose 1/3 of the neurons in your cortex in the first 4 years of postnatal life. So you start out, you know, with one, after a while you overproduce, and then you sculpt away. You need to have this sculpting process in order to get down to what the most important core of your cortical processing mechanism is. So you actually lose many cells, you lose connections between cells, you lose brain pathways. In a young baby, there's actually a direct pathway connecting the visual cortex and the auditory cortex. And by 3 years of age, it's gone. Just isn't there anymore. We don't need it. And it looks as though the rules by which these pathways are eliminated depend on the usage to which they have been put during early development. Now let me just make that notion a bit more concrete. This is a slide. And if you look at the top of the slide, you see a series of faint lines of all different orientations. Now, what I want you to do, those of you who have glasses, I want you to take your glasses off and look at that series of lines of different orientations and tell me whether you see all of these orientations with equal clarity. Are some of them a little bit more fuzzy? Like for some of you, do you see the horizontal lines that are over here more clearly? Or do you see the vertical lines that are at the bottom more clearly? If you're unsure, just tilt your head through 90 degrees and see if some of the lines change their clarity. You should do this with your glasses off. How many of you have some kind of a problem, if you will, or have some kind of anisotropy? Okay, there are some people, a fair number of you in the audience. Okay, so those of you who have this problem are suffering from a visual disorder called astigmatism. And astigmatism basically results from the fact that your cornea, instead of being shaped like an orange, is shaped like a lemon. So it's more curved in one dimension than it is in the other dimension. And this is a peripheral problem, basically a problem of corneal growth, and some of you have it. Now, when you put your glasses back on, for many of you, is the problem completely resolved, or do some of you still have the problem even after you put your glasses back on? Hands up. Some of you still do. Okay, I see some hands there. Well, you know, there could be two reasons why you've got this problem. One is that, you haven't been to your friendly ophthalmologist recently and he hasn't prescribed the right set of glasses. But actually, it may well be that you know, we can solve the peripheral problem. What we do is we simply grind a pair of lenses in which the lemon is standing upright instead of sideways, just complementary to the defect that your cornea naturally has. But it is possible that some of you are wearing the best set of glasses that money can buy that are completely compensating for your astigmatism, and yet you still have difficulties in seeing all these contours as equally clear. And the reason for this now is that the problem is no longer in your eye. The problem is in your brain. Okay. What happens is, if you chance to grow up during the first few years of postnatal life with a disorder like astigmatism, which effectively will blur certain contours. So if you've got astigmatism, as I mentioned, the world may look like this to you or like this, depending on which contours are blurred. And if you chance to grow up in a world, for instance, where vertical contours are always blurred, never very useful to you in your daily life, then what actually happens is that your cortex organizes to deal with that contingency and devotes less attention and actually less space to dealing with vertical objects. Now let me show you what I mean by that. If you look at the surface of the cortex, and this is actually the surface of the monkey cortex, and we and others have actually put little electrodes into this cortex and all these different places and recorded the activity. And remember, this is this map that you saw on the previous slide. So over here, you might be interested in what's right in front, and over there, you might be interested in something off to the side. Can you see those little black lines of different orientations? Some of you can, I guess, in the front. Well, it turns out that at every point, cells are interested in a particular orientation, some horizontal, some vertical, some oblique. And the next slide is actually a computer reconstruction of that cortex, which shows you how different orientations are represented on the surface of that cortex. And so the red areas are parts of your brain that are interested in horizontal, the green areas are parts of your brain interested in vertical, and then the obliques are in different colors. Now, what you can see here is that there's roughly equal amounts of cortical territory interested in horizontal and vertical and obliques. But if you chance to grow up in a world where, for instance, you're prevented from seeing vertical contours, and that could be because we create that kind of world in an experimental animal, we induce astigmatism, or because you happen to have astigmatism and it doesn't get corrected until you get to school or till you're in grade 3. Well, what happens is that the vast preponderance of your cortex is taken over by the orientation that was seen clearly, and you get very little cortical territory left for the orientation that was not seen clearly. So this slide shows you what happens if you raise animals, and this can be cats or monkeys or other animals, in an environment in which only vertical contours are clearly. What you do is you simply count the number of neurons that are interested in vertical, and you see that there are lots of them in this animal that was reared in a world with vertical predominating and horizontal stimuli blurred. There actually aren't any analyzers for horizontal. And this is the converse situation in which you grow up in a world where horizontal stimuli are clear and vertical stimuli are blurred, and you actually don't have, later on when you're an adult, very much cortex, if at all, that is interested in analyzing vertical stimuli. So if you find yourself in this situation as a child, and you're not diagnosed until later in life, 8, 10, 12, and then you go to your friendly ophthalmologist and he prescribes to you the best set of glasses money can buy, it may be too late, because your brain has already made the decision that vertical is uninteresting and I'm just not going to devote very much territory to it. And that's all there is to it. We can fix the peripheral defect, but we cannot at this moment fix the brain. So, let me just give you another example of how things sort out in brain development. What you're looking at here is a picture of the receiving layer of the brain of a young animal. And what happens, what you're looking at is, this is layer 4, the receiving layer of the cortex, the part that things come into. And you see these alternate light and dark spots. Well, what they are territories representing the left eye and the right eye. And this is an older animal now, 13 weeks of age. And what you can see is that the cortex is parcelated out. Each eye has half of this cortex, roughly half. Now, in younger and younger animals, what actually happens, if you look here, you can see a continuous line. So this is the territory representing one eye. It occupies all of the input layer of the cortex. If you could look at the other eye, it too would occupy the entire cortex. So when you're young, each eye owns the whole cortex. And then, as you get older, the eyes lose cortical territory and they segregate out to form patches that each eye can own. Now, it turns out that the rules underlying this segregation are actually very interesting and non-trivial. Let me just show you what these patches look like from the top. Okay. So if you're looking here, what you can see, you're looking now at the top of the brain, and you see these light and dark stripes. They are actually, this is 1 millimeter, this scale bar. And what you see across the surface of the cortex are these alternating lines of light and dark, which represent the left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye. Now, in a normal animal, this is a monkey, each eye has half of the cortical pie. And that's as it should be, because you need each eye to have half of the cortex in order to have the two eyes work together to judge depth. What you're looking at now are the responses of a single cell in your cortex to stimuli which vary in basically space and time, which are the correlates of different distances from you. And in a normal brain, the two eyes work together in a harmonious fashion. They cooperate. And it is this cooperation that is the basis of stereo vision, the kind of three-dimensional vision that you need to get on in this world. Now, let's say it turns out that one eye isn't so good during early development. Let's say you have a cataract, which is really, it's a peripheral defect, your lens is opaque, and you just don't see things very clearly through that one eye. Well, this can be a temporary situation and can be cured by your ophthalmologist if he catches it in time. But if he doesn't catch it in time, what happens is that instead of getting this, you get no binocular cooperation. And in fact, what happens is if one eye sends a degraded message to the cortex early in life, instead of having a cooperative synthetic process between the two eyes, the two eyes engage in essentially a Darwinian ruthless competition. And input from the eye that is, quote, normal, basically suppresses input from the eye that is abnormal. So if you look here, you see that there are still fragments of black in a sea of white. The fragments of black are the residual, the small residual territory still held by the eye that didn't send a clear message to the cortex during early development. Instead of each eye getting 50% of your cortex, the eye that saw clearly takes over the cortex and essentially gets about 80 or even 90% of the cortical territory. So the rule that seems to operate in cortical development is that initially everything is overlapped. There are pathways from both eyes to the whole cortex, and everything is possible. Then with normal development, everything sort of pushes aside and gets itself organized, and each eye gets half of the cortical pie. But if it turns out that one input to the cortex is less salient, is less important, is less clear, then the other input takes over. And instead of getting cooperation, we get competition. So the message is that we have the potential to use both eyes to influence our cortex. But if we can't use one eye, we lose it. And this use it or lose it metaphor is a very powerful one that applies throughout brain development. What we do is we keep the pathways. We're going to lose one third of our cortical neurons. We're going to lose pathways, synapses, connections. And what we're going to do is we're going to keep the ones for our later brain development and architecture. We're going to keep the ones that are most important, that are perceived to be most useful during the first few years of postnatal life. And even a temporary imbalance can lead to permanent consequences. Now, I've talked about early in life. Well, what do I mean by this? This slide is taken from work by my colleague, Dr. Donald Mitchell, who has analyzed the critical period for brain development. And especially with regard to lazy eye, which is the disease that I talked to you about where one eye doesn't see very well. Now, this is an analysis of a whole bunch of different studies where people had cataracts in one eye that started at a particular age and then had them removed at a particular age. And what you're looking at is how well did they see at the end of all this? Okay, a visual acuity of one means 20/20 vision. So here's a group of people who had a cataract in one eye from the ages of 21 to 24 years of age. And then at 24 it was removed, and how well did they see? Well, the answer is they saw fine. Their visual acuity was normal. Okay. Now have a look down here. Here's some people, here's some children, who in the first year of life had cataracts that lasted a few weeks. And then the cataract was removed. And if you look out here, you see that a few weeks of deleterious exposure during the first year of life resulted in 0.05. Well, 0.05 is 20 over 400. That's very bad. That's legally blind. So a few weeks of abnormal vision early in life can cause catastrophic effects. Now, here's another situation where you had cataracts for a year at about 3 or 4 years of age or bad vision. And here's a situation where you were not treated for the first 2 years of life. And at this point, we have light perception, which means these people can't see anything. They can't count the number of fingers you've got. You put up your fingers in front of them, they don't know how many you've got. So what this slide is telling us is that there's a tremendous dependence on age. That what the inputs that are, the inputs which are not useful during the first few years of life, and you can see that this is sort of a continuous process, but it's very strongly biased to the first few years of life. The inputs that are not useful in the first few years of life, namely an eye that says, look, I'm not telling this brain anything very interesting. And what the brain does is it just says, fine, it's not telling me anything very interesting. I have to get rid of a large amount of pathways, neurons, synapses, etc. This is the pathway I'm going to eliminate. And once it's eliminated, it's basically very hard to get it back, especially after the critical period. Now, what we've been doing is trying to understand what goes on in the brain during this critical period. Because really, what this is telling us is that in the early years of our lives, the visual cortex, where all of this is going on, is specialized to learn. It is specialized to change its architecture to deal with what is coming in, to decide this is important and I'm going to pay attention to it. And what we have found, and I'm not going to take you through all the details, what we have found, and other labs are working very hard on this as well, is that it looks as though there is a special biochemical architecture that arises in our cortex when we're young, when we're born. It's not there yet. During the critical period, what we get is the turning on of an entire genetic program, a collection of enzymes, of receptors, of growth factors, of ion channels that mark a piece of brain that is plastic, that can be changed by its input. And then, as the critical period wanes, most of this architecture disappears and is actually shut off. Now, it turns out that this is really a genetic molecular architecture. And what it does is it facilitates learning. What it does is to reward inputs that are useful and strong and to punish and eliminate inputs that are weak or ineffective. Now, the result of this kind of work has been actually to make me and many other scientists aware of the tremendous interaction between genes and the visual environment in which organisms find themselves. And this slide is really to show you that DNA, which is what this is coming at us all in a very big way. What you're looking at is a DNA molecule, and this slide symbolizes what is happening now in contemporary brain research. What we're seeing is a tremendous coalescence between molecular biology, molecular genetics, and neuroscience and brain, namely brain research. These two fields are merging because it has become obvious that what goes on during the critical period in the brain is that a new genetic program is being turned on. And it turns out that the tools of the Human Genome Project are the very tools that we need to understand this new biochemical architecture. Now let me just tell you a little bit about genes, about DNA. DNA is the basic unit of heredity, the molecule that is involved in transmitting our genes to our to the next generation. DNA is arranged on 23 chromosomes, and you can see them all here. An enormously ambitious and extraordinarily successful scientific undertaking is going on right now, and I don't think that the community really knows as much about it as I think we ought to. And this is called the Human Genome Project. Scientists across the world are working together in an extraordinary display of cooperation to basically try to decipher the entire human genome. Now, DNA is just it's a molecule that is made up of four bases repeating endlessly. There are a total of 3 billion bases. It's a four-letter alphabet, 3 billion bases. And the human genome, all the information in the DNA, would fill 200 telephone books of 1,000 pages each. Now, you know, that's a lot, but it's not infinite. And in fact, the goal of the Human Genome Project is to provide a complete genetic map, basically a map of each chromosome. Okay? We want to determine the sequence of the whole human genome, and this is going on, and to find all the genes. And the goal of the Human Genome Project, which is, I believe we're talking about $6 or $7 billion, which is not really that much in the overall scheme of things, if you think of the importance of it all, is to basically find the entire sequence of the human genome and find all the genes. And the goal is to be done by the year 2003. And actually, it's very much on schedule, and actually even ahead of schedule. I can tell you that the implications of this for biology are going to be, I think earth-shattering is not too strong a term. Now, it turns out that most of those 3 billion bases of DNA are actually not going to be, are not sort of equally useful. So only 3% of the total genome consists of DNA that is going to be made into proteins. Okay? The other 97%, I've written down here that it determines where and when the 3% that is going to be made into protein is going to be made, is going to be turned on. But the answer is that of that 97% of that DNA, some of it we don't have any idea what it does. Some of it is junk. Some of it may only exist to reproduce itself. It views you as a convenient vehicle to reproduce itself. And from your point of view, from its point of view, you're a necessary evil. It's quite an interesting concept to think about, actually. But only 3% of that genome is made into proteins, and there are about 100,000 genes in the human genome that comprise this 3%. So the 100,000 genes are that actually rather small part of the human genome that will be made into proteins. And now the Human Genome Project is a government-supported, academic, largely academic exercise with big sequencing centers and international cooperation. But I can tell you that there is unbelievable value in understanding these 100,000 genes. And even though the Human Genome Project will not be finished until 2002 or 2003, those 100,000 genes have already been identified. They basically, we know at least something about virtually all of them already. When I say we, I unfortunately don't actually mean we. I mean that perhaps a dozen biotechnology companies hold most of these genes in private databases. I can tell you that patents have been filed on virtually all 100,000 of these genes, and that some patents have already issued. So I think it's something that we ought to be thinking about. Okay. Now, it turns out, of these 100,000 genes, that not all of them are turned on or expressed all the time. So there are 100,000 genes that are going to be made into roughly 100,000 proteins, and one third of them are expressed primarily in the brain. So a big part of molecular genetics is actually brain research when you come right down to it. And an individual cell in your body may only turn on about 10,000 of those 100,000 genes. Okay, and you know it is in turning on its collection of genes that distinguishes cells that are going to be part of the lens from cells that are going to be part of your big toe, from cells that are going to be part of your ear, from cells that are going to be part of your cortex or another structure in your brain. So basically, gene expression again narrows down what's going to be expressed. Now, many of these 10,000 genes are what are called housekeeping genes. They're genes that are involved in staying alive, living, breathing, excreting, doing the normal functions that keeps cells going. And there are a relatively even much smaller number of genes which are really concerned with the uniqueness of a particular cell in the body, a particular tissue in the body, or a particular situation in the body. And there are now powerful techniques to identify which genes are turned on selectively in a particular situation or in a particular tissue. Okay. And I'm telling you this because what we're looking for are the genes of the critical period. Our goal, we know now that there is a genetic program, a collection, an orderly, orchestrated collection of genes that are turned on in a piece of brain that is ready to learn. And then when that period of learning, when that period of plasticity is over, those genes are turned off. And what we have done, and this is work in our lab with Dr. Shiv Prasad, is basically, I'm going to take you again through all the details, but what we have is, what we can do is we can sort of take all the genes that are expressed in a piece of cortex that is highly plastic, and we can subtract away all the genes that are also expressed in a piece of cortex that is not plastic, that is not able to learn, that is past its critical period. And we go through a lot of steps where we biotinylate things, we paint some genes green, we paint some genes red. It turns out that if they're the same in both tissues, that the red and green ones come together and turn black, and then we can precipitate those away. And what we're left with in the end is a very small number of genes. We estimate that there's like 99% overlap between a cortex that is plastic and a cortex that is not plastic. Less than 1% of the genes are different. And what we think we have now down here are about 100 genes that represent the genes of neuroplasticity. And this represents the pattern of gene expression that is turned on in a piece of brain when it's ready to learn. And we're very interested in these. The next slide shows you that these are the proteins that these genes give rise to. And what you're seeing here is a sort of canonical neuron up there. That's the cell body. That's the terminal of the neuron. And what you're seeing are that in each compartment of the neuron, proteins determined by these genes are turned on
In the mitochondria, certain proteins are turned on. In the nucleus, certain genes are turned on. And basically, a cell that is at the height of its critical period displays a particular and specific pattern of genes for a while, and then the critical period passes, and these genes are turned off. And some of these genes have to do with growth factors, others have to do with receptors. Each one has a story, but it's very exciting to be able to use these kinds of techniques to be able to determine what the pattern of genetic expression is associated with basic processes. And we've done this now to find the genes that are turned on in plasticity. I can tell you that parallel efforts are being made around the world. We've got all kinds of people who are doing the same sort of approach to identify genes that are turned on in various disease states, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And what is being created now worldwide is a database of expression of genes that are associated with key situations. We're trying to understand the genes that distinguish a neuron that is going to die, that is sick, from a neuron that is losing a developmental competition, from a neuron that is winning a developmental competition. And this general strategy looks like it's going to be extraordinarily fruitful and very, very powerful. Now, what it looks like is that we're going to be able to visualize an architecture, a molecular architecture for neuroplasticity. And when we talk about the critical period, what I've done thus far is to focus on the visual cortex, but there's actually a very big cortex out there to think about. So what you're seeing here is a side view of the monkey brain. Can you see this here? This is the front of the brain, this is the back of the brain, and this is the cortex unfolded. And you see all these different colors, they each represent different cortical areas. There's evidence now for over 32 cortical areas dealing with vision. All these areas in color are dealing with vision. And we know that they're different areas because each one of them has essentially its own map of the visual world. Remember I said there's this map where the front is over here and the periphery is over there? Well, each one of these areas, this is V1, the visual cortex I've been talking about, and this is V2 over here, and then there's V3, and each of these areas looks like it's doing a somewhat different job. And there's evidence for dysfunction in different areas in different diseases. So by now, there's actually evidence that this area here, MT, do you see it? There's evidence that visual information does not reach MT properly in children with dyslexia. Specific loss. It gets to V1, but this part of the brain looks like it's going to be very important in the reading process. Now, we believe, again, that there's going to be a critical period for this phenomenon. We know that there is a genetic predisposition toward dyslexia, but we believe that this is exacerbated by a competitive interaction early in development. There's lots of sorting out that's going to take place in the first few years of life. And what you can have is a weakness, a predisposing condition that is set up for one reason or another, that is then exacerbated by developmental competitions. Now, there are critical periods here in V1 that we know a lot about. There are also critical periods in sensory cortex. This part of the brain is involved in touch. There are critical periods involved in the auditory cortex over here. And there's evidence for critical periods in smell as well. Now, importantly, we know now that different parts of the brain are going through their critical period at different times. What we hope to be able to do is to recognize, by taking advantage of this knowledge of brain biochemistry that we're acquiring, to recognize what part of the brain is at its most plastic at any given time. So as I said, there will be examples in vision, in audition, in the different senses, but also in more complex tasks. Language development, there's very good evidence that people who are not exposed to a particular language early in life, that when they learn it, they still learn it, but they don't learn it in the same way as a native speaker does. And in fact, there's evidence that they use a different piece of their brain and quite different processing mechanisms. When it comes to skills like skiing, riding a bike, swimming, you can usually tell, mathematics, you can usually tell those who had their training early in life and who showed greatness early in life. It's quite different to look at someone who learned to ski at 25 like me and someone who learned to ski at 5 like my daughter. They just are going to be completely different. Now, what we're interested in is finding out which parts of the brain are most plastic at a given age, and the implications of this knowledge, if we can acquire it for education, are really going to be quite profound. By using techniques like PET imaging, functional MRI, and other scanning technologies that are on the horizon now, we're going to be able to understand not only which parts of the brain are active during particular tasks, but we're going to know what parts of the brain are most ready to learn at any given instant. And I think when we have this kind of information, and I don't think it's going to take that long to acquire it, I think we're talking years and not decades, that we're going to be able to tailor our education to those parts of the brain that are most ready to learn. And I think we need to do that. Now, the long-term goal of the research in our lab is to bring back the critical period. What we really want to do is to take people like yourselves and myself, who are, you know, old and largely past our critical periods, and I guess what I like to say is, at best, we're a good set of fixed opinions now. And to try, what we would like to do would be to recreate the plasticity that characterizes the young organism in people of our age. And so what I've, and in fact, there's some reason to be hopeful in this regard. There are at least three different ways that we can extend brain plasticity. One way is quite interesting. That's not to use your brain. And that applies to various university students I've encountered in my day. There's evidence, for instance, that if you take an animal and you keep it in the dark for the first few years of life, and this has actually been done with children also, that animal can be kept in the brain, can be kept in the dark long past its critical period, its chronologically defined critical period. And then when it comes out, it turns out that the brain is still plastic. So if you don't use it, you don't lose it in that sense. You don't lose your critical period unless you use your brain. So that's exciting, because what it tells us is that the critical period is not simply a biological clock ticking away. It is not simply a precise function of age. It's a state of the brain that normally correlates with age. It gives us hope that we can modify it. We've had very good success now in our lab, quite exciting results, work done by Chang Gu in our group, who has shown that adding growth factors of the right sort to the visual cortex looks as though it can rekindle some parts of that critical period. And so we actually are using this now in our model systems to try to cure lazy eye and that kind of astigmatism that I talked about earlier on in the or the brain consequences of astigmatism that I talked about earlier on. And this is a very promising approach. I think in the long run, the strategy that we and others are going to be following is going to be gene therapy. So this slide shows you I think one of the most important consequences of the genomics revolution is going to be gene therapy. By understanding the pattern of gene expression that characterizes critical periods, that characterizes disease, genes themselves are going to become medicines. Well, I shouldn't say are going to become, because gene therapy is actually here. There are now, I believe, over 100 different clinical trials using genes as the primary therapeutic vehicle that are going on in the United States or Europe or Japan right now. When we understand the patterns of gene expression that are associated with a particular state, desirable or undesirable, we have the potential to modify them. And there's a worldwide effort now, primarily in the private sector, but also in the universities, to try to develop tools to deliver genes to the brain and to the rest of the body. And I should say that groups here in Vancouver are very heavily involved in this effort and are working hard to make this a reality. Well, let me just talk a little bit about the good news and the bad news of the Human Genome Project. Being able to identify all these genes and understand where and when they're turned on, I believe is going to revolutionize neuroscience in particular and medicine in general. We're going to have accurate diagnoses for inherited diseases. We're going to develop animal models which have exactly the same kinds of genetic defects. We're going to figure out which genes are wrong in disease processes. And we're going to have new kinds of therapeutics. I think that in the next 10 years, the kinds of therapies that we're going to be seeing I think it's going to be staggering. I can tell you we're at a wonderful time, quite an amazing time, I think, in the drug discovery and in the new therapeutics area. That's the good news. The bad news, there's a lot of bad news. Actually, it's a whole fairly dense slide. I couldn't figure out how to compress it into much less. Is that there are a lot of issues that are raised by this new power. First of all, diagnostic capabilities are racing ahead of therapeutics. So we now have several tests that we can administer to someone. Let's say you have, you can be told now unequivocally that you have an incurable disease, and 20 years from now you're going to be, you know, demented, incontinent, and die. Do you want to find out? Well, should you find out? Should your insurance company find out? Well, your insurance company wants to know very badly, and is trying very hard to acquire this information, and. It's going to. I'm not going to try to propose solutions. What I want to do really is only to raise the issues. The other problem, and this is something that as an academic scientist I find very disturbing, is that the private sector has really taken the lead. So those genes of the critical period that I showed you before, they were found in 1993. They represented the work of two or three people about a year. We cloned and sequenced 134 genes. It's a terrific accomplishment in 1993. At this point, there are at least 20 different biotechnology companies that could do that project in a week. And in the next 5 years, people are going to be able to do it in a couple days or an hour. There are chips now that are being developed. Everything's in the private sector that are going to be able to analyze all 100,000 genes. And you're going to be able to take your drop of diseased tissue, and it's going to tell you which of these 100,000 genes are on, and your drop of normal tissue, and it's going to tell you which of the 100,000 genes are on in that tissue. Now, unfortunately, this is all too expensive for academics. And I think it's very clear now that academics are losing ground and losing the ability to compete. I think that the future in this area, unfortunately, for better or worse, belongs to the biotech industry. Now, the biotech industry now is hundreds of companies. And it's good because they're all driven by the imperative of bringing products to market. So that's good. But the bad news is that they don't have the same motivation to share information as university scientists do. They don't get credit for publishing work. In fact, it's usually in their interest to patent, if they can, and to keep other information completely secret, to not even let it get out at all. And I think that there's a very real danger that the free flow of information that we have, that has allowed us to get this far is about to be cut off. I can tell you now that some of the best databases are in the private sector and are completely unavailable. There are public databases, and I've heard the chairman or the chief scientists of these private sector companies say, great, we love you guys to keep producing data for the public databases because they just become a subset of our database. And that's fine, so we're working for them in a sense. But we cannot get access to this, and I have tried, believe me. So the other question is, the other issue, of course, is that the ability to analyze gene expression may deny jobs, insurance coverage, and medical benefits to people. If you've got a problem, whether it's a problem that is genetically, that is a result of your parents and grandparents, or even something that has happened to you early in life and you now have an altered pattern of gene expression that can be detected, this will impact your future health, and it may deny you, as I said, these kinds of benefits that we now take for granted. In addition, this is very much high-tech medicine. Gene therapy is not going to come to Rwanda for quite a long time. But even within countries like Canada and the United States, there's a real danger that the costs of this kind of medicine are going to outstrip our ability to pay for it. And I think we really have to worry about the prospects of a two-tier medical system, one for the rich and one for the poor, or some graded system. But we have 1,400 biotechnology companies in the United States, all trying to bring products to market, all planning to get rich. And if they all get rich, the cost of medical care has to skyrocket. There just is no way around it. And yet this is what is happening as we speak. Well, I'm showing this slide to remind you that medical research is a continuous upward climb, which goes on and on and on and on, and never actually ends. And this slide is really to remind me to thank my colleagues, because you really can't do this work without having a lot of friends, colleagues, and collaborators that you work with and learn from. This is just a partial list of the many people that I've worked with over the years, and I thank them all for this. And the last slide is really just for you to look at, and it's just to remind you of what a seething cauldron your visual system really is, and to look at the activity of your brain. And it also is meant to remind you, and I hope to leave you with the metaphor of the tremendous state of excitement and ferment that currently characterizes the interface between brain research and molecular biology. I think these are very exciting and powerful times, and I think things are going to be very, very different in the future. Thank you very much for your attention.
I think that's left us with lots of questions. Who wants to start?
Yes, I wonder if I can ask you repeat the question.
What percentage of the human genome is occupied by introns that don't appear to do anything whatever?
The question is, what percentage of the human genome is occupied by introns that don't appear to do anything whatever? I think the answer is that only 3% of the human genome actually is made into protein. The other 97%, as I said, it's probably not entirely useless. It's involved in, among these introns, are parts of their jobs may be to determine where and when that 3% is turned on. But it may be that up to 97% of it is useless. But we're sequencing it.
You said, sir, that 95% of the useless genome, that some of it existed just for self-reproduction. Is that involved in cancer, perhaps, or is it not?
I don't think it's usually thought of in those terms. I think it's interesting just sort of philosophically, especially. The question is about this DNA that exists to reproduce itself, and might it be involved in cancer? There's been tremendous progress in our understanding of the mechanisms of cancer. I'm not really qualified to give such a talk, but I read the literature, and it is very dramatic what is going on. I think the consequences for therapy are going to be coming at us in the same way as that DNA molecule. And I can tell you that those advances are at the level of molecular genetics and molecular biology. But I don't think that parasitic DNA is particularly thought to be involved in cancer.
Over there?
Of?
Who had cataracts at the age of 5, was legally blind for many years, and through hard work and will became a fully sighted person. I mean, his vision now is something like 70/20, and his autobiography is out there in the literature. Or there are people like my father, for example, at the age of 70, who through exercise, corrected.
I think that the answer is...
The question is, first of all...
It's hard to repeat the question. Okay. The question is, what is the role of will or spirit or consciousness in these processes? The questioner described various examples of individuals who were past their critical periods, who nonetheless were looked to be able to repair, in some cases by themselves, deficits that we would normally think of as being critical period dependent. I think the answer to your question is that will, spirit, and consciousness are all very important. There is abundant evidence, for instance, that your survival in diseases like cancer and other disorders, including some neurodegenerative disorders, is correlated with your spirit having a positive outlook. One of the issues in cancer is, one of the current hottest therapies in the molecular genetics of cancer now is to stimulate the immune system appropriately. And in fact, if you can keep your immune system charged up by exercising, and even by having a positive attitude, it's known that that will affect the functioning of your immune system, that there is no reason to think that that cannot help. So yes, positive thinking is incredibly powerful, and it's not just something that Norman Vincent Peale made up. It really is important. And yet, there are mechanisms that we are groping toward understanding in the modern techno-medicine world in which I live, to try to understand how that takes place. But that wisdom has been around long before us, and will probably be around long after us. In terms of how this helps to, in terms of how this helps some people do things that most of us cannot, the answer is we don't know. We don't understand, or at least we don't yet understand. If we did understand, we would try to use that knowledge and apply it to everyone. But I think it certainly bears investigation.
Yes, here.
Did you say that not only lab animals, but also children have been kept in the dark longer than a normal group?
Oh, this is a terrible story. Children have been, about lab animals and children being kept in the dark past the critical period. Yes, there are terrible stories of, one child who was basically, found chained in some dungeon at 12 years of age. Caspar Hauser is the term. You can look it up in their various books about it. It's not a pretty story.
Back there, and then here.
Is will and attitude genetically determined?
Well, is will and attitude genetically determined? These are very hard questions. I think, the answer is yes, partially. I think it's all a product of our brain, or at least I believe it is. And insofar as genetics plays a critical role in organizing and causing our brain to develop as it is, it must be related.
I'd like to ask, in relation to health care, you to elaborate on some of the implications of what you said about costs and how those costs should be met.
He's an economist.
Okay. I think there's some key implications. I think we should.
What's the question?
What do you think are the some of the implications of this toward healthcare, and in particular healthcare economics? One of the nostrums that we want to focus on is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I think we want to devote resources to the first few years of postnatal life. I think we want to focus on mothers and children. I think we want to try for early diagnosis of a broad range of disorders, from visual and sensory dysfunctions to attachment disorders to dyslexia to early signs of diseases like schizophrenia that we now, usually we don't find out about these things until, the child who's by now a young adult or teenager presents. And at this point, the cost of rehabilitation is catastrophic. Usually, by the time someone, has their first psychotic break, it's, 50 years of medical care. The cost, you can imagine that. If we can pick up these things early in life and devise preventative therapies, if we can finding the genes, for instance, that predispose towards some of these disorders is going to be extremely important from a preventative medicine point of view. I think that's the medicine we want to be doing. It's going to be much, much cheaper than trying to cure these things.
So video games and all kinds of virtual reality for infants in the crib?
I'm not sure.
Yes.
I'm interested in motion sickness. Mm-hmm. Something I do not suffer from myself. Mm-hmm. Some people up in the air, down to earth, or all at sea, suffer terribly.
Yes.
A new product has been brought out, born as a bracelet, propounded by the acupuncturist, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, does perception, visual perception, have much to do with motion sickness? And secondly, are these peculiar nostrums suitable?
The question is, the individual, the gentleman has an interest in motion sickness and wonders whether these bracelets and things like this that people are prescribing or are being given now and various acupuncture techniques are useful, and second, whether vision has anything to do with motion sickness. I can't really answer the first question. I'm afraid I don't really know much about these bracelets. But motion sickness definitely does involve vision. It's, you know, basically you have a few different ways in which you sense that you're moving. And, you know, when your head moves, you get two kinds of cues. One is the semicircular canals inside your ear, and the other is your visual system. And they actually have very different time dynamics. Let me just show you. Like, take your hand and go like this, just fast, okay? Just try to see if you can catch your fingers. You see that? No, you can't see it, okay? Now, rotate your head at the same speed, and you'll find that you can actually see your fingers clearly. And the reason for that is that, okay, it's good exercise too. And the reason for that is that your vestibular system, to put it in engineering terms, is a high-pass filtered system, which is actually able to operate very well at up to 5 cycles per second. So you can, whereas your visual system, to put it in engineering terms, is low-pass filtered and basically cuts out very badly more than once per second. Okay? And this mismatch is when, you know, when you're walking along in your everyday life, the two are complementary and harmonious and things are okay. But when you're subjected to jolts and jags, then, you know, the school of hard knocks, then these two systems, the mismatch becomes severe, and they actually send you different information. And you don't like that. And that's essentially the cause.
Question over here.
Learning, and some of us are more flexible in our ability to pick up new processes like computers and
Absolutely.
Technology than others. Perhaps instead of taking the risk that the biotech companies will start fixing everyone up with new genetic codes that don't really need fixing but need better social environments than they have now. Perhaps there's a correlation between turning off the plasticity at a certain age in a young child and turning on the socialization in a room in an incorrect way.
Well, let me, it's hard to summarize that, but basically the notion that came out was that some of us do have the ability to learn new things, and we're past 5 years of age. And that there is obviously, you know, and could this have anything to do with the social environment in which we find ourselves? Is that, that's not too hopeless an oversimplification. Let me just answer, if I can't answer your question, I'll answer another one. That's what my mother always told me to do. So, there is evidence that not all parts of the brain have their critical periods at the same time. And there is even evidence that some parts of the brain never finish their critical periods. So you really can teach some old dogs some new tricks. And I think, and while I said that one way that we know of to prolong the critical period is to not use a particular piece of brain at all, I like to believe, although I don't have evidence yet, and we're actually doing an experiment in the lab now, is that another way to prolong the critical period might be to do the opposite of not exercising it, namely to hyper-exercise it, to just keep it stimulated at all time. And, you know, this turns out to be a very complex experiment to do. It sounds easy, but and we are actually doing it. And I think if we can show that keeping a part of your brain constantly challenged will prolong its critical period, I think that'll actually be a very important demonstration and will have important implications for, you know, for a lot of things. So we're working on that, and I wish I could tell you the answer, and maybe if you have me back in 5 years, I will be able to. The relationship to socialization, I'm sorry, I just don't know.
Yes. There was a question way back there, yes.
Whether or not the concept of the gray-haired
I'm sorry?
Where does the
The concept of gray-haired wisdom, well, I think there's a difference between, brain plasticity and wisdom.
Question back there.
Perhaps.
What's the question?
Would people who are artists have longer plasticity periods in the visual system than in some other systems? Perhaps, but I don't think one needs to, believe that necessarily. I mean, some people may be very musically gifted and, have, other senses that they use to express their artistic side. And, I think people, there's only so much cortex. I should tell you, the cortex is a crumpled sheet. It's actually about the size of a small coffee table, if you flatten it all out. And we're going to allocate space on that cortex. And we have evidence that, there are all these different visual areas, and their very size may be dynamically regulated by what happens to you in the first few years of your life, and of course the history of your parents and grandparents, but maybe those the people who are exposed to the right kind of inputs early in life develop larger cortical territory devoted to a particular endeavor, and there's reason to believe this. I think one of the things that's going to be very exciting is, as our imaging technology gets better and better, I'm quite interested in people who are idiot savants, who can you say to them, what day was April the 7th, 1906, and they say, Wednesday. I mean, how do they do that? I mean, I'm quite interested in sort of trying to figure out, how much do they devote a lot of cortex to that? They may not be able to add, but they can do that, or they may, they may fail at other tasks. It may be that some process, has gone amok, if you will. And, instead of, allowing a very small amount of cortex to be devoted to one task, some positive feedback loop has gotten started, and they've devoted a whole bunch of space to that task. And they're very good at that, and as a consequence, they're very bad at some other things. So I think these kinds of things, as we develop the ability to image the brain, and I think this will come and is already really here in some measure with techniques like functional MRI, we're going to be able to answer questions of this sort.
There are many questions. I'm going to take two more. Back here, one.
What about the prenatal brain? Has anybody done anything on
that? Okay.
Yes,
so there's enormous amounts. Has anybody done any work on the prenatal brain? Oh, yes, I think there's enormous amounts of work being done on the prenatal brain. And again, postnatal development is, just one part of the developmental process, and it's a very active field of research. There are certainly some genes that are turned on specifically during prenatal development and are then turned off afterwards. There looks like there's an entire scaffolding of cortex that is built up and taken away largely before we're born. I could give you a whole other lecture on that.
Who's got their hand the highest for the last question? Over here, I think.
Thank you. As a person who has members of their family and generations of my family that will become profoundly affected by your present research in dyslexia and what you have said tonight about the private companies versus the academic research, I would like to ask if you have adequate funding for your research.
Well, I mean, the answer to that is always no. I do think you bring out an important point, an important general point, which is that, we're in a tough climate economically, and, government funding for medical research is being cut back. At the same time, there is a, tremendous sort of speculative froth that leads to, you know, companies being started with considerable funding. And I think right now, my own opinion is that the tide has swung really too far in the direction of private funding. I think there's actually a danger now of not having enough basic science in the universities and in the academic institutions, the hospitals, to support what we're going to need. And I think it's something that, sure, it sounds self-serving for an academic scientist to say this, but I think it really is true nonetheless.
In the areas of education, we need accessibility.
Max, I think, before I ask Jack Erpman to thank our speaker tonight, two quick questions again. Many of you have really enjoyed the talk tonight, all of you, and I urge you, again, those of you who haven't joined the Institute, please do so. It's very easy and painless, and will make you very happy if you leave the building. Next week, we have a treat for you, or quite a different treat, that also involves the visual cortex, because Big Tom, one of Vancouver's outstanding architects, will talk about designing a whole new city in China. That's next week here. I will now ask Jack Rutman, the head of the Department of Ophthalmology, and we clearly have a very diversified Department of Ophthalmology, to thank our speaker for his talk tonight.
Do you want this?
How does it work? Well, as you can tell, there's no lack of neuroplasticity in our speaker tonight, in spite of the fact that he suggested that neuroplasticity has a limited period. He's somehow demonstrated the opposite. They say we should be blessed to live in interesting times. But for a department head, it's more exciting to live with interesting people. And Max, as you can see, is one of those people in spades. His finest qualities, I think, have been demonstrated tonight here insofar as he's shown his enthusiasm for developing new knowledge, creative lateral thinking, leadership, and a keen sense of intellectual opportunism. Max is really a genius, but more than that, he's a dynamo of brilliant energy, constantly challenging the status quo. We have weekly meetings, and usually he comes in and he says, "Now, what have I got to bother you about this week?" And it goes on for about an hour. The presence of Max and his team of scientists is not only an asset to our department, but I think it is an asset to our university and to our country. The activities in his division range all the way from subjects of psychophysics, electrophysiology, as you've heard, interest in dyslexia, molecular genetics, and robotics, just to mention a few of them. A couple weeks ago, we heard the new president of the university, Martha Piper, talk about brain power. I think this week, Max has demonstrated it. Thank you.